before I get into my subject, I would like to make a little detour to show to some people some pictures that I was asked to show after my talk on Monday. And they are in the book I wrote a couple of years ago. It's very, very short. And so it is actually part of my big presentation the other day, and I went back by very rapidly about through the pictures, the first pictures of the what became Mandelbrot set. They were done in fact 750 platform, and the most striking thing about the one to the right, which was not quite the first one, but the other had the same thing, is that there were all this dirt around, all these dust and so on. Now, I first credited or debited to the red foam machine that we had, again, this VAC 750 and then a Vasatec printer. I am very cautious, so I became concerned, made some tests, and then became surprised by that some of these things, the dirt was symmetric on top and bottom. So dirt should not be symmetric, and dirt not being symmetric. Closer, in fact, there was something, a structure there. The structure which almost escaped my eye and then escaped the printer. When I sent the thing to the printer, I had pages saying, printer, watch out, all this dirt is part of the picture, not erasing it. Again, again, again. So the proofs, the dirt was there. I saw the galleys in the page proofs. I saw the printed version. Of course, the last person to check it. Taken away dirt. So the paper spoke about the dirt being an important discovery. All right. Well, anyhow, go back there. Dirt is quite dreadful. And that's where I made these various conjectures about which later were proven about connectedness and so on. Now, I will now stop and go on to the kind of my current work. Because, like most people, what's happening now. Concerning most, there is this paper which from part of, which is a bilateral transfer cascade. It's a complicated title, but the key for it, which may actually become a title when the paper is published, is a way of obtaining Brown motion by multiplication. So a fable has become very widespread. The people in the know it is not true, but it's very widely believed that to obtain fractal function like Brown motion or fractional Brown motion, you use additive procedures, and to obtain multifractals, you use multiplicative procedures. Well, it was true, often true, but certainly not true in every case. And here is a very, very simple, elementary, in fact, amazingly straightforward way of obtaining a certain number of perfectly fractal curves with constant H, constant Hausdorff and Hölder properties, which are obtained by multiplication. Now, they're not obtained by interpolation, but by refinement. And that you will see momentarily what that means. And so let me read it, and then draw on the blackboard what's about it. So you start with the state origin density of 1, or minus 1 if you prefer, but let's say 1, on 0, 1, and B a base, and P is a parameter, B is 0 and 1. Actually, limits P equals 0 and P equals 1 are interesting, and I'm going to mention them, but they are so trivial that they're left outside of this construction. So the first the construction stage divides the unit into B sub intervals, and multiplies the density each by either 1 or minus 1 with proper frequencies, 1 half plus P over 2 and 1 half minus P over 2. Well, why do we do it? I will show it momentarily by a motivating example. And then what happens after that? So you have a broken line. At every stage, it's a thing is that you begin by initiator with straight line here, and the generator is this broken line here. So horizontally 1/4, vertically 1/2. And then you iterate it, and you obtain this curve. I attract attention to it, I think as a long history, in the mid-80s, and there's a literature on that. But then one may generalize and say, what happens if you randomize that curve? Now, how to randomize it? Well, you start with an interval again from the whole generator, divide time into four parts, and the first one you multiply by +1, the second one by -1. I say one, in fact, that can be another quantity because you may normalize earlier than. And then -1, and +1, +1. Therefore, you either multiply by plus, that's the 3/4 time, or by minus, which is 1/4 time. So let's just take, allow P, the probability of E plus and minus, to be anything you want, between 0 and 1. Why not? I could go ahead go in by more motivation, but basically this is the initial motivation. This construction here, you have on the line grid. In the construction, I now introduce, and which is again, which I have been studying. The horizontal grid exists vertically. It's an example of canonical construction in a sense. I gave to canonical in my first paper on multifractal, which was in 1974. That is, the multipliers in each interval are statistically independent. And so, in other words, here the sum is exactly 1, is an interpolation, because the constraint have just 1 negative and 3 positive, but if you take the probability, you can change it. Well, now let me give you the result, which we found extremely surprising, which I proved by a very by physical argument, which was full of holes, and then Julien Barat, who is a close friend with whom I've written a number of papers that were mentioned momentarily, proved that indeed those conjectures and new ones are correct. So first of all, let's take the case of P very close to 1. H, actually, H means. P very close to 1. If P will equal to 1, then you always go multiply by 1. Therefore, the whole thing, every stage will be the same. And the thing for P, no interest. But when P is very close to 1, which this is an example of, the fact converges to a limit. In fact, converges rather rapidly after 27 stages. It just concentrates there. It's a strong convergence of every kind. I mean, the limit has the same Helder and Hausdorff property as the defined by value h, where h is a function of p. I'm going to write down. Now here is another example of h equal 1/7, and again there is convergence. Now here is an example of h equal 0.5, and there is no convergence. There's convergence in distribution. And convergence equal to what? To minor? Well, it was misspelled, but it's a name that, like mine, seems to invite misspelling. So, to minor Brown motion, you go from stage to stage and you get another minor Brown motion. There's some vague resemblance which gets maintained over parts of the process. And not others. Now let's go in the direction. And what happened between, what happened between that this weak convergence is indeed the case whenever P is less than 1/2, and whenever H, which is going to be given here, is less than 1/2 also, in the case of B equal 2. This H is pretty far from 1/2. Next one is H is negative. Yes, H is negative. Here, this vague resemblance between successive things has vanished. So these are all processes which are precisely independent Gaussian increments. All the approximating curves are have middle intervals of slope either 1 or minus 1. The B are the bar A intervals, but you no longer see it because it's at this stage. You see it in the first one on top. After 8 stages, you see that the slope is always 1 absolute value. And that's a famous modification. Let me immediately try to put that in the framework of the sums of random variables. You have, if the expectation is finite, you get the low cash number. If the expectation, so you have the sum, and nothing has to be taken out, divided by proper renormalization, and that tends towards the suitable Cauchy stable limit. If the expectation is finite, you must subtract the expectation and difference gives you central theorem. So here, the next step was to see what happens actually. What happens if we subtracted that limit process, that approximation here, from the limit? There is a kind of noise. Here is a kind of approximation error, if you wish. And that approximation error is itself Wiener-Brown motion. So Wiener-Brown motion occurs in one or two forms, either always in the limit, which is a limit of weak convergence, either superposed upon convergence to limit, like in Borel, strong low large number, or just by itself, as the central limit theorem of that we know and enjoy. Now, how does it go? The kind of calculations, I'm not going to write them. First of all, I hate to do it. And secondly, it's rather dull. And thirdly, it's an archive, so you can find it very easy. I'll go back to reference for those who are interested. The basic fact is that it falls in the category of the canonical multifractals as defined in, again, the first paper on the subject, which is my paper of 24. But the multipliers are changed from being necessarily positive to being positive or negative. And then, in the first case, adjusting the height of the intervals, or putting a factor to make it into a martingale, a measure martingale, and that measure martingale may or may not have a limit. For H larger than 1/2, it has a limit. And there are additional reasons to believe that, the finiteness of second moment and so on. And for H less than 1/2, the limit is actually infinite. It just becomes more bigger and bigger. So you need a different rescaling when the limit given by Martingale is infinite, and even have it. Let me go a bit further to show a few numbers. So what? Well, actually. this was not, oh yes. So here's factor, the sigma H factor is what we have, what we need to apply to it to obtain this. In one case for H greater than 1/2, it is to replace something that becomes very, very small with something which is finite and has limited behavior. In the other case, something which diverges, the same formula is essentially applied in both cases. What's remarkable here is that H, which is familiar to anybody who has worked with fractional back motion, that H can be negative. And a negative H would be an absurd thing for fractional back motion. It would be, in fact, absurd under very wide conditions. But here, one doesn't have to worry. Because when H is less than 1/2, then the limit does not depend upon H. Only the factor which allows you to get the limit is because of H. So, again, it is not interpolation. It has many other properties. And I just, again, invite anybody who wants to play with such thing to look at. Oh, wait a minute, that's what I'm doing. I wanted to go. Well, all right, so I should have continued some formulas here, but probably even. Well, you can see theorem 1 that gives the factor of sigma H, which is what before, and here H, and here is H greater than 1/2, and here the factor of convergence. The next thing, the remainder of this talk, I'm going to discuss various forms of negative dimensions in multifractals. And before I go that, I realized that upon working on the most recent examples, that my papers on negative dimensions were very close to being illegible. So with Michael Frame, who is always ready to take another job, because if you want to have a job done, you ask a man who's already very busy. Michael Frame joined me, and I had to explain to Michael Frame in extreme detail what I wanted to say. And then we're writing this article, which will discuss negative dimension. Now, the reason why negative dimension is important is because in the picture, in the formula that John Key gave us, the f of alpha is negative for small enough alpha or big enough alpha. And these values, the question is, what does it mean to have negative values? Now, let me still try to do something. Yes, if anybody wants to read the archive, number of dub, please, you're welcome. Let me see. Do I need this thing for any longer? I need it. I'm extremely well organized. Being all my record of trying to do many things. Yes, so here is a little bit about the intervention, which I may perhaps discuss. Now, dimensions can be introduced in many fashions. And here, example of dimensions of intersections in very simple shapes in 3D. And now, there is a rule which everybody knows and which didn't have to be written down specifically, which is that if you have the intersection of two sets of dimensions D1 and D2, what you do is to take the codimension C1, which is E, the sets are here embedded in the space, and here C2 equals E minus D. You take the sum C1 plus C2, and two things may happen. Either that sum is less than get the dimension of the intersection of two lines in space, the dimension you get is minus one, which is not meaningless. I think that is it for a second. And then if you get it here, the point and the line, you get minus two. Now it's meaningless, but in fact it's meaningful. Why? Because thinking about all these phenomena, I follow very, very closely the way in which Minkowski said that dimension should be, or surface should be examined. He said, never think of straight lines or of surfaces. Think of epsilon neighborhoods of straight lines. And so you, so thinking here of a plane in a line, a point, you think of epsilon neighborhood of something. Then you look at the epsilon neighborhood of the final construction. Well, the difficulty here, we don't deal with epsilon neighborhood, the ordinary one, the pseudo neighborhood. It is not the neighborhood of the limit of the intersection, but the intersection of the epsilon neighborhood. By a modulo of this enormous addition, you find that all kinds of classical formulas apply in this context, and that you obtain any dimension you wish. In particular, here by taking 5 points, you get dimension minus 12. Now, is that the imagination? So here, is imagination. Well, it is in some sense imagination, but in fact, in many cases, many specific cases, it's not imagination and fantasy. It is very well specified construction. Because here's an example of birth and death canonical fractal set. Divide the square into 4, you probability, the very probability you eliminate, you either keep or eliminate the fourth, do it again and again and again. And there is a theorem, which I think is Gulch or Weber, a very old theorem, which gives you these results of these dimensions. Now, if you look at the plane construction, at the tracer construction along any of the sides of it, you find that the dimension corresponding to it is that one minus one by the argument I did before. And so, when you find that the dimension set is minus one, there is a good reason. A good reason to say, well, perhaps that set is not something freestanding, but something which represents the intersection of what I'm looking for with a two-dimensional set of positive and small dimension. And if I repeat again and again measurements of dimension on a increasing number of samples of that set, it's all in the sense, of what to say, then you obtain estimates of dimension. And this has been done again and again. Sorry, I have forgotten these slides there. But maybe I should make a point, if you allow me a parenthesis, because given the orderliness of my thing. These were pictures of iteration which I obtained the year before I discovered Mani Rosetta, and I showed them because at that time I was at IEM and we had a marvelous graphic system which we had done ourselves, which was great. And I saw Mani Rosetta in many places, for example, here on top, I saw it, but I never understood what the heck it was. I couldn't come closer, I couldn't look at it. It's only when I went to Harvard and got this dreadful system with the facts and so on that I could look at things carefully in detail. Well, I'm sorry about this thing. How fast we should talk?
You want to switch?
Yes, completely. Okay, so I switch completely, and if I can get some light, I would like to get back to. Okay, right on the left. the context of autograph functions, as they are introduced in this paper in 1974, in which Eco Balta is first introduced. So the basic idea there is first of all to simplify, and secondly to be close to the study of turbulence, which was my object, by doing that multi-fractals, not supported by a fractal, but supported by straight line. Now, specifically, the topic I was interested in was the study of turbulence in the laboratory. So the way in which laboratory must study turbulence is to have a very complicated apparatus of wires, and then the flow goes around it, and you make measurements of, for example, dissipation of energy. And so the question was, what do these measurements done around something which is an approximation to a line tell you about the dissipation in the whole system? And the kind of naive thinking, which was natural, in fact, which was sponsored by Kolmogorov, one of the probably few mistakes he made in his life, but somebody like Kolmogorov makes a mistake, it's a beauty, and it was very difficult to fix. What he assumed was a kind of distribution of energy, of dissipation, whatever. It's more complicated. In fact, this theory of homogeneous turbulence in 41, and Landau, in which assumed that dissipation was uniform in space, and Landau pointed out with him that it was ridiculous that turbulence, if you have it in large vessels like the atmosphere, is never homogeneous. There are storms and there are puffs of air and so on, and therefore one had to take account of the discontinuity or the variability of dissipation. So Kolmogorov said, well, let's assume that it's a cascade. The idea of cascade was, in this context, actually familiar from the constructions of Bezukhovich, and that at each of the cascade, the multiplier. So here, for this interval 0, 1, the cascade multiplied by factor W1, forget that, and then you divide into 2. Well, actually, I'm combining Kolmogorov and Yagnon, but that's all right. And then here multiply by W1 and W1, and here W1 and W2. It wasn't terribly clear how these were constrained. Then you apply center limit theorem. You find the log normal distribution for dissipation, and that's it. And so he postulates a third postulate of turbulence in which the dissipation follows the log normal distribution. Unfortunately, this log normal distribution had bizarre properties, like the moments were decreasing as the system was increasing. Anyhow, it was something filled with extraordinary complications and impossibilities, which nobody dared question. I dared question it and carried out under some simplification this construction, and then Kahn and Verrier proved to me the results, which I then published in Journal of Fluid Mechanics and so on. But the basic idea is that you have a cascade W1, W2, and so on, and you, at each time you subdivide, you multiply by again a certain factor. Now this factor, one can be is positive, and one can assume that this expectation is equal to 1. And that's something which will be important for that in a moment. And that was what happened. Well, in some sense, the log normal distribution N theorem which concerns central distribution is irrelevant, and that we almost apply the Cramer theory of last negations, and last negations is one by me. But the main thing is that about convergence, assuming W of t like that is one, one has a martingale there, and the martingale converges, both positive martingale converges, but may converge to zero. I guess that a condition for convergence for convergence of positive, which Breyer and Kahn confirmed. But the main question was that each time it depended upon the dimensional set you were working on. So it could work here on the line, or it could work here on a square, or it could work on a cube of dimension E. And so in the cube of dimension E, you've got a dimensional measure. And therefore, it was very for each value, for each function multiplier W, you obtained a critical dimension such that if you are a dimension which is too small for W, the limit is zero. But if you have a dimension which is high enough for W, the intersection is something real. And so how do you work in practice to extract this from experiments? Well, what you do is to try to set up your experiment as some kind of equivalent of setting experiment in multi-dimensional space. So for example, what I recommended to Srinivasan was in doing experiments is not to have one single leader, but to have a series of instruments to measure the dimensions and the velocity, and therefore dissipation. And by having this series of sequence of instruments, what he was obtaining was a way of repeating the experiment with again, 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 and obtaining by theorem, which is in part very conjectural, but which is in part provable, obtain the result that this amounted to having a dimension, bigger and bigger dimension, therefore a limit which was not degenerate to zero. But the one point I think I left open so far, which is what is the dependence between the different multipliers. Now there are different ways of choosing it. The simplest one, which in effect was used by Bezikovic when he defined binomial dimension in the 1920s, was to take here a certain measure M, and here 1 minus M. Either in that order, M being between 0 and 1. Either in that order or random, it makes no difference in formalism. And then the next stage, you again take the measure M, so here is M square, M minus 1, etc. etc. And so what the Kovic did was to obtain the formula for the dimensional support as being the same as the entropy. And the measure itself is very naive and simple process, being significant for some values. It becomes the mass in an interval becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and almost everywhere is zero. I'm sorry, I thought I'd taken, wrote a diskette with that, but I haven't. But this was very something very, very primitive. The underlying idea can be implemented as follows, that you have a function here, a side function, which is W of t, which is periodic, and which is equal to m here, and 1 minus m here. So then you consider a product of functions, Wt, then W2t, W4t, etc. And you see what happens. Well, Bezikovic showed is that what happens is that at each stage the function, but in the limit it's a measure, said this before, that when you can take a function which is again in each interval, it can have some kind of binary system. So here you a value w1, w2, and limit and constraint w1, w2 to add to 1. That I call the conservative or microcanonical case. You can leave w1, w2 statistically independent, and you can do other things as well. But in any case, this corresponds to taking functions of this sort, which are slightly more complicated. And altogether, what I've been doing for a long time without knowing it was to study limits of products of functions. Now, I did not know that Ries had done that. There are a few examples of it, but this had very little contact with Ries because Ries had not worried about fractal properties. But then the question, and also let's go back to a very broad context, let's take some function, some not even a random distribution, but some well-defined function w, and periodic. So let's take this periodic function, positive, and look at the product. What will come out of it? Now, just in terms of amusing little detail of history, this thing started with Marco Levi Coppens, who is a chemical engineer that Bernard knows very well in this room, and who came to see me and said, well, I've done some simulation of that and products, and it gives a lot of fractals. And I looked at the program it was doing. He did not normalize W to be equal to 1. He just took a function, then took the product, and normalized it after having taken the product. So it was a limit. I was very angry because I said, well, why do you complicate your life? And so we worked on it quite a long time, and finally got terribly stuck, and then Baran came in, and he worked very hard with Baran. He did most of the work, found the fact that this sequence this problem is much more complicated than we thought. First of all, except under very, very strange and artificial looking conditions, which I'm not going to write because they require half an hour for preliminaries, there is no convergence, when it's to zero. But something extraordinary happens. If you take this function, say between 0 and 1 here, and divide it with the sample, the integral corresponding to this, so if you have this function here, then take integral, this ratio here has a limit. The function itself is 0, but automatically its ratio lifts it up, and you have a limit process. So I would like to stop here to make a general plea. I would like to draw attention to this paper, which appeared in the Journal de Mathématiques Pure Appliquée. It's in English. It's reasonably well written by Baral, Coppens, myself, in which the wealth of possibilities of products of these random functions is at least sketched. We just took this one example. We could have other examples of the way, but it's a very rich topic, which is worth looking at. In the meantime, I mentioned these products, and somebody in France whose name escapes me, who is Lamier, but we refer to him in that paper, has obtained some results of these products, which are parallel to what we're obtaining. But this represents the extreme complications that we found that were necessary. But now I'm getting to a second point, which is perhaps more important. How much time do I have?
10 minutes at least.
Okay. So, which is that, what do we learn when we get f of alpha? Because what f of alpha is expression of the moments of this measure, Cain of Alpha, can, like in your example, for example, the take negative values which have to be given mathematical meaning, which can, again, skip all that whole development, be given meaning in many ways. But how much do we learn from Echo Alpha? And what kind of variety of Echo Alphas can we expect? And so let me go back to this matter here of the two cases, the case where the limit was is a function or a measure, and in the canonical case, an independent multiplier, and the case where the limit is zero. Now, in both cases, there is a function of alpha, and this function of alpha has to be drawn in this fashion. It's on the line, on the line that looks like that. So it's the graph generically, in most cases, has this shape. Not most cases. So what kind of peculiarities can it have if one goes beyond this, which is true for the binomial case, which Kavich had done, the multinomial, which was very, very easy to do, and the more general case. As soon as you put randomness, what you find is that, again, not in all cases, but generally, you have a formal calculation of Echo Alpha, which does not go initially through the Hauser dimension, but with something which we call, that paper calls the test dimension, which is essentially the log of probability of finding the mass in a little interval. It is something which is very elementary. It's a formal dimension. There are many, many different forms. And that formal dimension is easy to evaluate. And it can very easily take negative values. What do they mean? Secondly, it may happen in some cases that this function here, instead of nicely going down this way, it may continue, and alpha can become negative. What do you mean alpha become negative? Alpha is supposed to be a Hilbert exponent, and certainly Hilbert exponent is going to be negative. And so then, what's the condition for alpha, for negative alpha to obtain? If you have this multiplier W, if W can take values greater than 2, so the probability of W being greater than 2 is positive, then you have this thing going to the negative thing. Now, what does this thing mean? Well, all that was actually fixed in my paper in 1974, except that it's written dreadfully and it's not illustrated. But let me give you the result to the response. You have the equation, a certain basic equation which is tau of q equals 0. And tau of q equals 0 has a standard general root which corresponds to equal to 1, which corresponds to this binomial. But when alpha is negative, there's a second root here. And if that second, if that is possible, then the slope of this root defines a tau critical. And the tau critical equation is what rules the tail of the measure we obtain. So let me repeat this because it sounds like a snake biting its own tail. So you have this measure you obtain by multiplicative cascade canonical. So the multipliers are independent. And this is true. So this measure mu is set random, and the measure in the little interval dt is a random variable. Well, the moments of that random variable are finite only up to q equals q critical. The moments are finite, and this is infinite here. value of your critic are something which you can observe. Make a big sample and look at the data and see what Q critical means. In other words, in this case, one can learn about these, in principle, ridiculous concepts of negative dimension and negative thunder by measurements of the most traditional type. And how does it happen? Well, the simplest case is to take an example of the generalization of binomial as follows. Instead of having, as I said before, some m here between here and then 1 minus m, the inverse, you take the two measures on both sides as independent of variables, the two values still, and one of these variables can is greater than 2. So the two possibilities are some large value with small probability and some small value with large probability. And by ranging by looking at f of alpha of this construction here, you get f of alphas which go to the left. This is described in gruesome detail in an article which unfortunately appeared in the Journal of Statistical Physics, which nobody reads, on the occasion of Michael Fisher's 70th birthday. It's on my web. So what happens is that in this particular thing, the first few stages of the construction in 0-1 determine to a large extent what the measures are going to be. If by fluke the first one multiplier is large and the next two are large and a few others are large, then the rest from there on things become quite normal and average out. But the mass in the interval is determined by the first few stages. It's application of Galton and Watson versus this model, a very simple one. But again, I would like to refer that paper, but repeat the main argument. Something which is completely invisible, impossible to examine, which in fact is theoretical, which is beyond the theorem of Kahn and Terrier, which says that this test dimension is indeed the Hausdorff dimension. Something like that can have property consequences on observable quantities which are perfectly observable. Now, let me again say, tau q equals zero has only one root in all the simplest cases, which are the only ones that Kolze looked at in the expository article that we referred to. This is a very, very significant case. Very often tau q has a risk, and this happens. Now, how general is tau q having roots? Well, how general is the cascade itself? Cascade is a very artificial construction, and so I developed a different model, which I've mentioned very briefly, and mentioned properly, in which the multipliers are not put in a grid, but implicitly strict grid, but you start with multipliers which are determined by Poisson process. I use that for many other purposes. So instead of having you multiply by W with this interval and by another W with this interval, and the length of the interval of the distribution are given by suitable Poisson process. In this generalization, which is a kind of scrambling up of cascade, tau q equals zero always has a root. Therefore, the q critical always exists. Therefore, multifractal time enters, and the multifractal time it must allow this possibility because it allows it to determine the properties of the price series that comes out of it. So, infinite number of questions arise, and what I would like to sort of underline now, as last word, is that from my first paper, I mentioned before, in fact, was a couple of papers before, but they were very specialized. But the first paper, 74, I tried to see, to act in a way, in a position against both the physicists and the mathematicians, the habits. It was not a heuristic approach, it was very precise, and each case was very rigorous. And it was not general. I was not seeking generality because I was seeking the kind of variety of behavior which can be obtained. And so now, among the things to be understood would be your f of alpha, which is unity, does not go beyond here. It's okay in this sense, but certainly becomes negative. What do negative values mean in practice? I have some ideas about it, but too vague to discuss with you today. And in general, to emphasize the extraordinary variety of behavior one can have, this thing need not go down, it can remain horizontal, and that has certain properties which are encountered perhaps in DNA, but which have not been studied, I think, sufficiently accurately. A study of multifractals which on purpose does not seek generality but seek special cases, because so far the special cases have been proven to be so useful separately, and also a study of multifractals in the context which I wrote here of products, because after the fact, even though this was not the beginning, especially except in the article with the three authors, we were looking at products of random of functions and their harmonics or rather log harmonics, since the frequencies have to be in parallel distribution. Well, I must apologize for my more than usual disorganized presentation, because I forgot one of my PowerPoints, and because I spent too much time on the preliminary.